You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour. And it is our final week here, Herds, on the peculiar Good Murder by Robert Gott. Chapters 10 to 13 is what we are discussing today, and that is all for this book. I have been the one in the solver's chair this time, Herds, and we will get into my solutions and whether or not I am getting points at the end of the show. I want to leave that as late as possible. That's I don't want to know out. Until very end.
Don't worry.
If I'm getting points for this, because I have enjoyed the tail end of this book so much. If you've been listening along with this, and I hope you have, you know that I've had a character arc of my own with this book. I found it overall a bit uncomfortable. I found it a bit confronting and overly similar to things that we've already covered on the show. But this final section really, really solidified it, and I think really made it stand out on its own rather than being as derivative as I felt it was.
Yeah. That's a very interesting kind of takeaway from it. I think for yourself, at least, for the way that you've kind of progressed through this book, you've hit it right on the head. I really enjoyed this book from start to finish, despite the hangups that I've mentioned in previous parts of this discussion. I think this is the most entertained I've been by a murder mystery in a very long time, just laughing every step of the way. As we watch a character completely devolve into madness.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Usually these stories are about characters, you know, coming together as they solve something. That's usually how the Watson Sherlock relationship goes. In this story, it's the opposite. The Watsons, as they are, Peter Topaz and Annie Hudson, are driven further and further away from Will as the story goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And Will, he is the way that I like to think about him as a character as this story goes on, is that he's like a bad fan of murder mystery fiction who's actually asked to solve a murder case, and they have no idea what they're doing.
Yeah. I mean, there are so many lines. I would point out specific sentences of people accusing Will's character, but it's such a theme of the novel that you could really just flip to a random page and probably find one. It's just constant. Yep. Every time he's put in a situation where he could be in control, he doesn't listen to the people around him and it gets out of control. If you're the kind of person that watches horror movies and stops when people make obviously fallacious decisions that are going to get them killed, then this book is going to be similar trouble for you.
Yep.
But on the other hand, if you are a fan of that kind of thing where people lose control, it's going to be really good. We've compared this a lot to Simon Brett's work, which we covered earlier on this year, and I've said on previous episodes that they felt like very similar stories of an overconfident male actor losing control of a situation and trying to solve this murder mystery. But without spoiling any of the plot specifics of Simon Brett's work there, I think that Charles Parris gets further and further in control as his stories go on, as he learns to cope with his faults, whereas it's the other way around here with William Power, where he's getting further and further from control.
Charles Parris is shown to be, you know, self-doubting, and we're shown time and time again that he's out of touch with the kids. I use that as a phrase to show how relevant I am, of course. But William Power, of course, has the opposite problem, where he says, "Ah, yes, I will be the detective, and I will solve this because nobody else can." And this is some very interesting kind of meta commentary on the nature of the detective, that you expect the detective will find the criminal at the end of the story. And that is very much not what happens to William. He does not fulfill his role as the hero of the story. And I love that. I love that we get that, again, like, flipped on its head.
I mean, the other thing I will say about this is that I perhaps was a little unconvinced until we got into the tail end of this book that it was self-aware of the things that were challenging and grating about it.
Interesting.
But when we begin chapter 12 with William Powell walking out into a storm as the river floods and the world is collapsing around him, you know it's in on the joke. You know it is in on the fact that just everything is going wrong for this man. The world is collapsing around him and he's still just going headlong through it. It's brilliant. It's such an on-the-nose metaphor, but I absolutely love it.
It's just such a funny series of scenes, too, like, at a very base level, because he literally, like, he finds the hotel manager, Augie Kelly, and he's like, oh, what are you doing out here? He's like, well, my hotel's flooding. He's like, oh, that's, what are you doing out here, out in the rain? He's like, oh, you know, I'm just, like, seeing that you're okay. And then Augie disappears from the scene, and he, you know, walks into the fancier hotel where all of his friends, where all the power players are staying. And Eddie Hudson says, you can't be out here. And he's like, what do you mean? The entire roof was ripped off of the prison I was being held in. What was I supposed to do? Stay there? And she's like, yes, go back. Go sit in your roofless cell and wait for the police to come and collect you, you idiot. It's... sorry, it's just it's comedy at its finest. Robert Gott knows how to give me a good old chuckle.
Oh yeah, I mean, listen, I still think that the beginning portion of this book could do with a bit of work,
maybe
to perhaps make it a bit more welcoming for some readers like myself who might find it a bit challenging before they get to the good parts of the end of the story. The same with how some TV shows, you know, start off really weak and build up towards being better. The same with anything that is created progressively. And I do not discredit the book for the fact that it is that way, because it's such a common problem. But I also think it's such a shame, because the ending of this book is so strong because of things like this that I'm like, oh, I wish that it would open itself up a bit more to people.
Yeah, the punchline of this novel is so excellent. It's a shame that the setup takes such a long time to kind of settle properly.
Yeah, yeah.
I've been told the third book in the series is kind of the height. And so if you are interested in checking out Robert Gott's series on William Power, I can wholeheartedly recommend checking out the rest of the books, because apparently it only gets better from here. I know he ends up going to islands in the Pacific to, like, you know, cheer up the troops, but there's actually, like, spies involved.
Yeah.
And I can only imagine how William Power just, completely butchers an actual military setting.
I will say that is one of the other things that I will not necessarily fault this book for, but one thing that I was a little let down by is the fact that it didn't really use its premise at
setting.
All. It's setting it all, rather. You're right.
The strongest part of the setting, the way it's used in this book, is actually to set up Tybalt and his, like, cooking shenanigans.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that is much more relevant in the opening than it is continuing on. Even Annie is more of a hostage in the final scene than anything else. But that's fine, because that's why we have a larger cast, right?
To set things up
for future novels.
Yeah, and it's more of a palette than it is a wasted canvas.
Exactly.
Which is why I say I can't fault it for it. And I'm glad that we pressed on, and I'm glad that I didn't just throw in the towel with this book, because the ending was so great.
I told you.
But yeah, there definitely is some elements that I think, looking back on, we're unfortunate for how closed-minded I was to this book initially.
Are you admitting that you're closed-minded here on Death of the Reader, award-winning podcast Death of the Reader? Flex? Is that what's happening
here? You know what? I'm just going to go with yes.
Okay.
I was closed-minded coming into this
book. You were closed-minded? You're no longer closed-minded.
Exactly. But, thing is, if you are being closed-minded about anything, you have to be closed-minded in an open-minded way. You've got to let the outside rush in. You know, you can close the gates, but you've still got to have leaks around the outside.
Hold on, you have to let the outside rush in like water into an old hotel.
Exactly.
That is captained by a psychopath. Captained, you heard me, captained, because it's a motel or a hotel in the middle of the sea, in the middle of the water from the flood that's happening. You get it? It's like a ship.
I get it.
It's in the water. Yeah.
You've done it, Ben. You've saved metaphor. You single-handedly have saved the art of metaphor.
I'm here to make metaphors relevant again. That's really what this show is all about.
Actually, Herds, before we get into the mystery section, I need to know this before we throw to the music, take a break, gather our thoughts, and begin talking about the mystery.
Yep.
Did you think Fred Drummond's death was an accident?
No. I don't think anybody could have predicted that.
Okay,
I don't think that was
good.
Possible.
I'm glad to know that we can agree on that at least.
Look, we're on board, okay? We're like two peas in a pod. No, we are two peas in a pod. There we go. Now it's a metaphor.
Well, Herds, we will take that aforementioned break, gather our thoughts, and return with more
English jokes.
More on Robert Gott's Good Murder. This is Death of the Reader. We are discussing chapters 10 to 13 of that book, and we'll be back with you in just a second. You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here with you. We are speaking once again with Robert Gott, author of Good Murder, who last time on the show gave us some profound information about how memory is retained in amongst groups of people and how the historical events of the murder that inspired this case in Maryborough were changed and misconstrued over the years since it happened. Robert, it is so good to have you back on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
Last time on the show, I was a frustrated man. I was upset with William Power. I couldn't deal with some of the more grotesque moments of farce in this book. But
welcome to my world.
When we look at William Power, he does have a bit of a thin character arc. You spoke of him last week as a solipsistic, self-centered individual, though he doesn't have any extrinsic malice. He doesn't seem to make many amends by the end of the book. He's still just as frustrating at the end, you know, charging down self-righteously to the Witherburns mansion to bungle the investigation further. Is this why we can take so much joy at him being beaten, bruised, covered in old lady blood, arrested and tossed around by buildings destroying storms? Is it part of the joy of this series to put William Power through as much misery as possible?
That is absolutely, you are the first person to understand that. That is perfect. Yes, he must be punished in every book for being stupid. and yes, he doesn't get any smarter in any of the books. He gets slightly gentler, and he does learn a little bit by the end of the. There are four of them at the moment. I'm just about to start a fifth one.
Looking forward to it.
He doesn't really get very much smarter, but he does take an awful lot of punishment. That is true.
So when it comes to stories like this, where the main character doesn't really have an arc. You know, how can you still satisfy an audience that's looking for progression? Because I think what I enjoyed in this book, as I said last week, was kind of the curiosity of seeing how a chain of murders ended up being resolved, and then also the scale ramping up and just seeing William being punished. Are there other tricks that you can employ to keep the audience engaged when the detective is just a stalwart, stubborn mess of frustration?
Well, in my case, what I hope readers will stay around for is just the comedy. That I think there are a lot of jokes in the book. And because it's written in the first person, William Powell's sense of himself has to come across in his kind of self-conscious use of adjectives and adverbs. And I am absolutely antithetical to the kind of thinking about modern writing that says, get rid of adjectives, get rid of adverbs. I love adverbs. I love them. And this book gives me an opportunity to just throw them in.
Yeah.
And my excuse is, well, it's because it's written by William Power. So, of course, he's going to be over-elaborate in the way he speaks. He considers himself to be a classically trained actor. He's obsessed with Shakespeare and not the main plays of Shakespeare, the obscure plays of Shakespeare. And so, I guess that's my trick, but I want people to keep reading because it's funny.
Yeah.
I think it's that simple. I'm not that interested in the whodunit aspect. The thing about whodunit for me is at the end of the novel, the real murderer is revealed. And almost 100% of the time, I think, could have been him. It could have been any of the others convincingly. And the writer could just have said, no, I'll choose that one. And then I'll write a convincing explanation. I like the puzzle, and I like the trip through the novel, especially if it's nicely written and elegantly written. But I'm never, ever, ever really profoundly satisfied by the unveiling of the killer.
I suppose that is kind of inherently true because the author could have chosen any of the cast and written the story a little bit differently. But at the same time here on the show, we do cover rules and structures that kind of help pick apart why certain mysteries do and do not work, why some are satisfying and why not. So listen, Robert, I'm just saying, if you get the chance to listen to other episodes of Death of the Reader, it might save you from this murder mystery hell.
Oh, I'll be listening. Don't you worry.
So,
the only thing is that when you read about a crime writer's rules for writing a crime novel, like Raymond Chandler's rules for writing a crime novel, or Ronald Knox, as you said last time, or Elmore Leonard, particularly, all of those people, all they're really doing is telling you how to write a Raymond Chandler novel, or how to write an Elmore Leonard novel.
Mm.
And for example, I don't think there has to be one corpse and one detective. I'm all for peak corpse.
I mean, clearly.
Yeah. I like, you know, to litter the novel with bodies.
Mm.
It keeps you interested. I like the idea of not just whodunit, but who's next.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's kind of one of the things that I think did come across in this book really well the whole way through, even when I was frustrated with it, is that you were really exposing the inherent absurdity of the genre. The idea that we can come in with this cast of all of these suspicious characters and every single one of them could be the one that did it.
Yeah.
Like, it's just inherently a bit silly, and that's sometimes fun, but I really enjoyed the way that you played with this, where you just, your entire cast is despicable in one way or another. You know, what's the trick to weaving this tapestry of misinformation without overcrowding the show?
I think it's just instinct from reading. You have to be a big reader to be a good writer, I think. And don't forget also, in my defense, this is the first novel.
Mm.
And I've learned a lot about writing novels since I wrote this novel. So, because now it's my eighth novel. Mm. And whatever weaknesses are in it, and there are weaknesses in it, like I was never really satisfied with the rationale behind the killing in the end. I thought psychologically it was quite weak. But it's partly because I'm not that interested in the whodunit thing.
Yeah, yeah. I guess the curious thing there, and this is one thing that Herds has been speaking about on the show, is that there's kind of something amazing about the use that a lot of authors have either inadvertently or directly about love in the stories. And it seems that every character that you have in this story who has a genuine romantic connection is a good person.
Yeah.
Whereas when we look at Charlotte and her collapsing marriage, she ends up being just as much of a villain as the overall villain of the story. And I kind of like the way that a lot of authors, yourself included, use these other clues to point towards other aspects of the characters that make them morally upstanding or collapsing characters.
Yeah. It's also partly misdirection to try and make, you know, it's trying to create another suspect. I love film noir and I love femme fatale and I think that strong villainous women are fantastic.
Yeah. Now, one final question before we go. Usually a foolish protagonist like this would meet a cathartic end and his relationships and pride's wounded, his life would be forfeit after playing directly into a murderer's hands. Why has William Power not been killed yet? Is it coming?
Well,
is he going to meet a grisly end? What is the overall arc, or is he just an eternal punching bag?
Well, he's not the eternal punching bag. No, he's not going to get killed. He becomes, by the fifth novel, which I'm writing now, he becomes a very successful actor, oddly.
I'm shocked.
But it doesn't improve his intelligence.
Mm.
It just improves his finances. I don't like the idea of having to ultimately punish a character for foolishness by killing them. No, because I actually like Will. I've come to like Will. I love writing them because they're not dark and disturbing in the way that the other series is slightly dark and disturbing. So these are much more of a pleasure to write. For me, they're just a joy because I'm entertaining myself.
Mm.
And if they entertain other people, well, that's a real bonus.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point you make in there of kind of separating him being foolish from him being reprehensible. As you said last week, how he doesn't really have any explicit ill will towards other people. And I think that that's kind of a great thing that it took the course of Good Murder for me to learn. But I got there in the end, and I'm glad that I did. I nearly gave up on this book, Robert. I'll let you know. I nearly did, but I'm glad I got to the end.
Foolishness isn't immoral. High intelligence is what can be immoral.
Yeah, that's a take that I think no more should be said before we spiral into attacking people. Robert, thank you so much for joining us on Death of the Reader. It has been an absolute pleasure speaking with you and getting to the end of this book.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
We will have details up on the podcast about the rest of Robert's work, including the more recent releases and hopefully the fifth book coming as soon as it does.
Well, it's not written yet.
That's what Simon Brett said to us, and then he dropped a book nearly the week after we released the episode.
Well, my next book, which is at the publisher, is a sequel to The Autumn Murders, which is the third in the Darker series. Mm,
fantastic. You are listening to Death of the Reader. We are talking Good Murder by Robert Gott. We'll be back with more of that in just a second. You're listening to Death of the Reader. Flex and Herds here for your Murder Mystery World Tour. We are discussing Good Murder by Robert Gott, chapters 10 to the end of this salacious, outrageous, horrific murder mystery story.
I agree with all of those points. Those are all 100% accurate. It is also insane.
I wanted to say, before we continue on with this section,
yeah,
that all of the praise that I have heaped on this book in first half.
Are you about to just dunk on it?
Should not be undermined by the following criticisms I'm about to make.
Sure, throw it on me.
Because this mystery is a sham.
Sure.
I like the aspects of Augie Kelly being this insane killer who has this mental image of a friendship and relationship.
It's perfect.
With William Power. I like the way that it uses Fred's death to set up how that insanity came to manifest.
Sure.
The problem I have is that most of the setup for that is done in the scene in which it is revealed.
Yeah, no, I think that's totally fine. Look, I have no problem with that. It's part of the reason why I respect Robert Gott's like writing decisions so much. Kelly, you know, when he's saying, I was the bad guy all along, he literally says, like, you know, how did I know, you know, who needed to be killed next or where you were going to be? Well, sometimes you told me and sometimes I heard it through the walls. It was almost as though fate itself was asking me to, like, be your best friend, which I love because that's commentary on, you know, how murder mystery villains always seem to be exactly where they need to be for, like, the puzzle to work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also super brilliant. I've been thinking about this a lot since the last time we chatted, actually, how all of the people that William, and this is more of a thematic thing, so this might be why you're not gelling with so much, you know, because you don't get it. But but the fact that William, all the characters who he gets along with are bad guys, potentially. Like, they are messed up people. And I love that because it's a direct commentary on William Powell's perceptions of people and showing that he is completely wrong.
Yeah.
All the time. And I love that aspect. I love that, like, through line of all those characters.
And I think that's kind of where my problem lies.
Really?
Is not in that the story has done a bad job with those elements, but that either I think it should have gone harder on being a mystery or actively subverting mystery tropes.
Sure.
Or left the mystery tropes more to the wayside and gone harder on the thematics, because where it sits currently in the middle means that the subversions and commentary that it makes on the mystery genre feels thin.
It's a classic conversation, I think, and I think this is something we're just always going to be on opposite ends of like plot, whereas I'm more here to see the interesting ways that Robert Gott is commenting on the themes of murder mystery and the way that that he uses Will in particular, this like character stuff. Like, I find that to be much more interesting.
Oh yeah, no. But my point is that I think that it would have done the story more justice if it had committed to that more.
Sure.
I think that by catering to me less, it would have been a stronger story.
A stronger product? Yeah, I feel that. But I do like the fact that it is at least trying to be a murder mystery.
Yeah.
I don't think that the story falls apart. It might have been stronger, but it definitely is not, it is not incomprehensible, and everything makes sense by the end, except, of course, for Augie Kelly's death, which is wonderfully absurd. He literally just steps on a poison fish.
Well, yeah, and I think that that's a great example of what I think the novel should have done.
Yeah, sure.
In that moment is so ridiculous and so hilarious and fits so well with the scene around it that it just lands.
Mm-hmm.
It's a joke that lands. What didn't land was Fred Drummond.
Mm-hmm.
Pun intended.
I get it, because he flew up in the air and he exploded.
Yes, okay,
and he landed in the lake. I get it.
We've stuck on the joke for too long. This joke now isn't landing.
Hell yes.
That's
what I'm going for.
But the whole element of that story is that we spend so much time kind of dealing with the mystery and Will Powell trying to unravel it that when we get to the end and it is unveiled that Fred Drummond was just an accident.
Yeah, it doesn't, it feels a bit weird. A bit of a betrayal.
And
yeah.
I think that the usage in the overall story is incredibly strong because the idea that it was this message from the gods that you and I are the same, Will, that's fantastic. That's a great thematic.
It's hilarious.
But I think that so many of the great subversive stories I think of that I've read don't necessarily let you in on the idea that it is a subversion until it is revealed to you.
Sure.
And this element of the story, the plane crash, does that in that it doesn't let you in on the fact that it is a subversion. But the difference is that I don't think that it sets it up so that that reveal pays off.
If there was an extra character, like an inspector character who came in and was like, we're going to investigate this plane issue. There's a possibility that someone might be blowing up all these damn planes. And then it's like, I mean, that all again ties into using the setting, right?
Yeah.
Throw in, rather than this like ladies in the milkshake shop who are there for flavor, I guess.
Oh, you're from the circus.
They're fine. Well, that is a good bit, though, that they're all
it
like...
It is a great bit. It is a great
I love the bit, like, yeah, William, you're that circus guy. And he's like, no, I'm not from this. Stop saying that. Like, you're just perpetuating lies.
But ultimately, I think that despite the fact that this doesn't, you know, play nice with the mystery rules, even if it does loosely adhere to some of the Noxian things, that doesn't matter because that's not what is good about this book and good about this mystery.
Yeah, it's a joke.
Yeah.
It's a parody.
And, you know, I think that it's important to approach this book with that mindset.
Sure.
And going back to the idea of that I want the book to be more open is that I think that setting it up this way as a mystery means that you're going to throw off readers like myself who, if I hadn't been reading this for the show, I would have just stopped.
Yeah. You have to approach it, it's the same thing I talk about with all books of all genres. Like, you have to come in with the expectation of what story you're going to get into. If you're expecting, like, a hard-boiled detective solves the case, like, you're not going to get that. Mm-hmm. If you're looking for a goofy fun time, very absurd, plays loose with its plot and its characters, go read this book. It's amazing.
Yeah.
I suppose I should let you know... Flex, we're coming up on the end here.
Goodness.
We will be receiving a grand total of 1 point because
Look,
you're going to get that point because you did pick out, like, you forewent English jokes.
We're literature critics, everyone.
Hey, how you going? Okay. Shushy, don't you discredit me here. Okay. You forewent that 1 point in favor of not deciding on how the murders were carried out, which is a smart choice, but you did nail Augie Kelly. And what's more, you figured out the why, which I was really impressed with because it's, you know, that he really did want to be good friends with William Power and he wanted to, like, hang out with him and be the best buddy could by murdering anyone who said anything bad about him.
I will say, I do feel very, very vindicated by the fact that the reason I gave up that point was the reason that the other, like, the murders weren't solvable.
No, they weren't.
They were completely hand-waved.
No, it literally did not matter. And I mean,
if I just committed to that and said that it was the way the story was approaching it, I would have walked away with 2 points.
That is not just any point. That is a golden point. That is a point that you can hold above all else that you solved the murder of good murder.
I'm so proud of myself.
That's great. Congratulations. All right. You blew me away. So what are we doing for next week, Flex? Why don't you lay down the law?
So, Herds, next week we are making our long-slated, our long-fated transition to Eastern literature.
Yay!
We are going to be talking about Sherlock in Shanghai. This is a series of short stories portraying a Sherlock-Watson duo in Shanghai by Cheng Shaoqing, who is said by some to be the master of Eastern crime fiction. We're going to start next week with The Shoe, The Other Photograph, and The Odd Tenant, which are the first three short stories in this collection.
Okay. Why is it always the...
I don't know. You see, that's the one thing that Eastern literature still can't escape, is the unnecessary articles in their titles.
The unnecessary these. No, mm-hmm. See, I just said the unnecessary these. It's inescapable. It's the end. Oh, this is
we've ruined ourselves.
Terrible. Oh my goodness, bring the metaphors back. Is this something I can solve, or these are just short collections that we're going to blaze through?
It'll vary piece to piece. There will be kind of mysteries you can solve, and there will be points on the table.
Okay, sure.
But I don't think that you should go into them expecting the great construct.
Okay.
Anyhow, you have been listening to Death of the Reader. We are Flex and Herds. Thank you so much for joining us on this stop of your murder mystery world tour, Good Murder by Robert Gott. We will be back with Sherlock in Shanghai by Cheng Shao King next week on the show. See you then.